Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to start with tech radio here. I'm in for Kent Osborne today. But first, the update from the state on coronavirus. And there have been no changes in the state's update reporting since last evening. So in case you're new to those numbers, we right now have 14 positive COVID-19 tests in the state. 663 people have tested negative, and the state is still pending with 270 cases. They processed 94 high-risk tests yesterday. We're told they are working around the clock for that. Three of those tests came back positive, and 91 came back negative. So keep in mind that is 19 hours old as far as the data is concerned, so we'll keep you updated as soon as we have recent numbers. And you can find those updates at covid.sd.gov. That's the state page. It also links to the CDC guidelines if you're thinking about how to clean your house or work in your business. And then all of South Dakota Public Broadcasting's coverage is at sdpb.org/COVID. You can see those state numbers on the right-hand side of that SDPB website as well. So let's get started with tech radio. Our guests here, Amos Aesop, he's Chief Information Security Officer at Exigent Solutions in Sioux Falls. Amos, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
John T. Meyer, also on the phone, co-founder and CEO of Lemonly. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you?
Jeff Litterick is with us. He's a network engineer with the Bureau of Information and Technology in Peer. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, all.
And Craig Mount is a Google My Business product expert and founder of the digital marketing company Classy Brain, based in South Dakota. Craig Mount, nice to meet you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to get things started here, and feel free to bounce back and forth with your with each other as well as you do when Kent is hosting. But I want to talk about what this coronavirus has sort of exposed as far as fragility in some of our systems. And just from your point of view, what is one of the most important things that we need to get to? And I'll start with you, Amos.
You know, it has exposed a lot of things. And one of those things is a lack of significant planning when it comes time to have users who can't be in the office or need to work remotely. We have seen a number of our customers who typically have a few users who are working from home. Maybe they're traveling, maybe they're sick, but have a need to access their data from a location that's not inside their network. And that's something that's pretty common for most businesses that have those remote users, but it's pretty uncommon to have those remote users be the entire staff, right, or have everybody who's outside the network. And what that does is that puts a strain on the infrastructure that they have in place. And sometimes that requires more facilities, it requires more hardware, it requires more licensing, that sort of stuff. And so there's been a real scramble for businesses to be able to come up with the needs that they have in order to allow those workers to work from home. And in some cases, that's a VPN connection. But what we've seen a lot of really in the last 3 days has been workers who need to work from home but typically have a desktop computer, and businesses running out of portable laptops to be able to assign them to take home as well. So, you know, having to plan for your entire workforce being outside the facility is something that we don't typically see. You know, we don't have these sorts of issues all that often, and so it's been a real struggle for a lot of companies being able to come up with the resources to fulfill that need for the entire company. Mm.
Jeff Litterick, what are you seeing in regards to sort of, you know, fragility or I don't want to use the word scrambling because that makes it sound like a panic, but a sense of urgency about what needs to be done?
Well, sorry about that. One of the things that's been affecting Europe a little bit more than us is internet bandwidth. With everyone being home and stuff and the kids being home and streaming, Netflix yesterday agreed to basically turn off HD streaming to all their European customers. And YouTube this morning announced they are going to SD, standard definitions of HD streaming, in Europe also. I've been kind of watching the internet peering points in America and stuff. And it's higher. There is a lot more internet traffic out there, but it's not to any kind of critical where the internet's going to break yet. There has been basically in some of the collaboration tools like Teams, and Zoom and some of the other stuff that people use for remote means, there's been enough surge that there's been some issues with the services, but they've all fixed them fairly quickly. So most of the stuff is kind of elastic. It's mainly the end user trying to work from home for the first time and never had thought about how they were ever going to do that or plan for it. And then also having to, you know, deal with your kids and stuff also being around. And then, of course, any kind of remote education stuff's coming up here soon. So we're all kind of scrambling to be able to support that and make sure that all goes off without a hitch. So it's not as bad as I kind of imagine it might be, but things are elevated, but everything's holding together pretty good so far, at least in the United States.
Yeah, and that's interesting that Netflix can and would make a decision like that.
Yeah, the European consul actually asked them to do that because their internal peering nodes, and what I explain by peering nodes is the internet is a network of networks. When you talk to Yahoo, Yahoo's network to you being like on Midco, there's a bunch of networks in between. And the traffic has to go over these common peering points to cross these networks to get from you to Yahoo, you to Google, and so on. And they're kind of scattered all over the world, but all traffic goes through these peering points. And the peering points in Europe have been hit really hard. The ones in the United States are being hit hard, but we still have plenty of capacity. So they asked Netflix. I don't think they even asked YouTube. YouTube has kind of volunteered to say, we're going to standard definition video only by default, which actually reduces the bandwidth by quite a bit because most of the internet traffic that's been jumped up is streaming. With all the kids being at home, everyone at home, the streaming services are sending out more traffic than they've ever had before. So,
yeah. And Jeff mentioned, the users, people going home and trying to figure things out while their kids are also around. And I've even had a lot of friends who've been talking about working with their pets and some of the challenges that they're having with their animals. Well, at least one person had already put rice on her laptop because her cat knocked over her coffee. Craig Mount, talk a little bit about people trying to, figure out how to use some products. What are you seeing as pertinent right now in the beginning of our conversation?
So what I've been seeing, looking at, things from a user standpoint in a local economy, I'm seeing communication issues. And what I mean by that is communication issues with people amongst themselves. I'm seeing communication issues with businesses to the public. And it really does show kind of a weakness, so to speak, of our ability to adapt to online cultures. Mm-hmm. And specifically, for example, let's say you live in a neighborhood. How do you communicate with your neighbors now? Everybody's afraid to talk to each other. So what I've seen just personally, kind of living in the tech world, is more people relying on the app Nextdoor to get more information about maybe people in their neighborhood who need what they're calling, I think, grocery angels, something like that. People
sure.
who will actually, pick up groceries for people affected. And from a business perspective, they're having issues with communication to their consumers. How do I let people know that my office is closed? And, if you're a restaurant, how do I let you know that the dining room is closed, but takeout is still available, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've seen, like I said, a lot of weaknesses. Some really cool solutions are being developed, but this is all happening so quickly. So we're all kind of learning as we go.
John, one of the things we talked about yesterday on the show about artists was that a lot of people, just wait for a minute, because a lot of people are cleaning first. They're cleaning their facilities, and then, they're working about how do I get my employees, set up at home. And then I think we're going to see some really innovative solutions that Craig alluded to there. And John was on the show earlier this week talking about how Lemonly was pretty prepared to make the decision early. John T., how has that sort of been unfolding for the staff at Lemonly to be a little bit ahead of that game?
Yeah, I think work-wise, day-to-day, in terms of the actual work we do, has been good. I do think, I don't know who touched on it earlier, there's been an adjustment, though, just you know, lifestyle wise, and just, you know, if you have kids, if you have pets, if you know, I have employees who are also just single and live by themselves, which also can be very isolating. You know, so by the end of the week, a few things we've started, we now have a standing 8:30, Zoom coffee, and anybody, it's, you know, optional meeting, and you can just join at 8:30, and assuming you're probably at home drinking your coffee and just literally talking small talk. So we call those water cooler moments, at Lemonly. And when you do remote work, we've always had remote employees as this, a minority of our staff. You need to find some way to create these water cooler moments, because that's what we're really going to miss in this isolation and in this social distancing. So I think we've felt it more on the personal side than we probably have on the professional side. But yeah, I think there's an adjustment in everything from access to the larger companies, data, the stuff that Amos mentioned, to just the lifestyle, right? We're all working through this, and you have to give everybody a little bit of grace and some patience right now.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of people who have embraced that online culture, and there are challenges to it. We've talked on this program before about loneliness or isolation or intimacy. But for people who embrace that online culture and have, you know, their homes kind of set up to be spaces that are electronically connected, they're also pretty confident right now, and some people are scrambling to catch up. I want to talk about a couple things, including security, and then I get to some basic questions about how do you clean your cell phone and how do you set up effectively, a space for connectivity. But let's start about security, because once people move, move to home, and not only are there phishing and scam attempts that we're seeing nationwide, and I've had a few phishing emails already. I had a phone call, somebody asking me about my health insurance. People are out there, the bad actors are in play. So Jeff Lederich, let's start with you. Efforts for cybersecurity, how do you make those decisions about, hey, we have to loosen the grip a little bit and make sure people can connect from their houses, but also we cannot compromise that security?
Well, in some cases, you don't really have to for your home workers. It kind of depends on the technologies you're using to allow your home workers to connect remotely. There's some, like at the state, where it really doesn't lessen any security. And they have full access yet to all the stuff they've always had. So there are solutions out there. Now, on the number of attacks and phishing, they're increasing every day. We're seeing more and more on our infrastructure, probes and stuff. Everyone's at home, so there's more time to play. And also, they think everyone's at home, so people aren't watching the networks, but we are. And yes, there's more and more spam all focused on this, on the virus and stuff. You really have to pay attention and stuff. And it's a good time, especially if you're a home worker, make sure your home is updated, your home computers, especially your router, make sure that you are running the latest software on them. There are security risks that can allow people to hijack computers if you have open routers and stuff from vulnerabilities. So it's really good time to make sure you have everything updated and solid. And then if you're using VPNs and stuff, you're much better, but, do remember you are, you know, having a computer that can be attacked on a home network that would normally be behind your corporate firewall. So, but usually that's pretty well been protected by your corporate IT security already. So
how do you update a home router? Is that just regularly updating your computer? Or is it something different?
Well, it's pretty much the same way. All home routers are just computers. And they all have, at least internally, and you should not open this for external. Many will allow you to do that, but internally, they have a login, and it's usually going to be web-based. And if you go through your router documentation, when you first set it up, you may have actually had to log into the router. You should always log into the router. There's a username and password, which you should change and then record. And then most routers can either be set to auto-update or someplace in that interface, it depends on the router manufacturer, it'll usually be a big flashing button say, hey, you're out of date, you need to update your firmware. So it's a pretty easy process. You're going to click, the router will pretty much auto update itself and then reboot, just like a computer would be. So be aware that, you know, everything's going to go down for a couple of minutes as it reboots. But you should be doing that pretty familiar. Most routers have security updates every 3 to 4 months. if not more often, just like computers do. So if you have it updated, it's that you bought it, it's pretty much open to attack on the internet. You do need to keep it updated. Like I said, many now will auto update no matter what automatically, but log in, change your username and password on it for sure. And there'll be an automated process in there to check the firmware version. So
who else has thoughts on security? Amos, let's talk a little bit about, keeping things secure as in a time of disruption.
Sure. We've had a number of folks call who are asking, what do we do with the users who aren't used to working from home? They maybe don't have security as top of mind when it comes to connecting. And Jeff's right. One of the things we tell them about first is to make sure that they've got a firewall in place, which is just another name for a router, making sure that router is up to date and it's got the password changed on it. The other things, of course, would be making sure that your computer is up to date with all of the latest Windows updates. We talk about that quite frequently on this show, but even now with the number of home users, the bad guys are aware of that, and they're just going to redouble their efforts to look for machines that are not up to date and have holes in them that would allow them to get access. The other thing is, like you mentioned, is being really aware of emails that are coming in or even phone calls that are coming in. You know, now with the potential for money that may be given out by the government, I've heard of phone calls happening already where someone says, hey, in order to get this money, you're going to need to, pay a deposit or pay some sort of preemptive fee in order to make sure that you get that. And of course, those are false. And so making sure that you're just vigilant on your email and when someone calls, those kind of calls are happening so frequently these days that we would hope people would recognize them as soon as they do, or as soon as they get them. But we certainly hear about the terrible stories of people being duped out of money, sometimes in the tens of thousands of dollars. And then the other thing that I mentioned, too, is that if at all possible, try not to use any sort of open wireless internet. These would be wireless access points at coffee shops or libraries or other areas that you wouldn't be at home where you don't have to use a password to get on. That's asking for a little bit of trouble as well. So just staying away from those is a good idea.
And Heather Benson's going to join us a little later in the hour. And one of the things that I'm hoping we can talk with her about is this idea that when there's a lot of new users right now. There might be elderly people in nursing homes that staff is trying to hook them up with iPads so that they can talk to their loved ones. You're going to have an influx of people who really are starting from scratch as far as learning stuff. We are going to go ahead and take a break, and then we'll come back with Tech Radio in just a moment. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. I'm in for Kent Osborne today on Tech Radio. And we've got Craig Mount and John T. Meyer, Jeff Litterick, and Amos Aesop with us today. Let's talk a little bit about how many people are asking, how the heck do I disinfect my cell phones or my computer equipment, which, ew, gross, means you were never doing it before, first of all. But who wants to take that question as far as caring for your electronic equipment and also not spreading germs because there's heightened awareness? John T., you want to start?
Well, I know I can speak from the Apple standpoint. It's been a long time Apple person. I know if you have an iPhone 11 or 10 and any of the versions, 11 plus, things like that, you're actually safe to wash it. It's waterproof. The 11 is waterproof. I think the 10 is water resistant. But Apple came out and said, yeah, you can wash it. That's a weird sensation the first time you do it. And you stick your phone underneath the sink because you kind of freak out. But yeah, you can do that. I would be more comfortable doing that than some more of like the Clorox wipes or some of those things that have more chemicals or more material in them. So I know from an Apple standpoint, that's true. And Android, Amos, I would imagine the same, right?
Yeah, depending on what version you're at, the later ones are was severely water resistant, waterproof. I guess it you know, it depends on how far. How
yeah, it may not be like the water. I wouldn't go swimming with it. Yeah.
right, exactly. Yeah, one of the things that, and we, I think we talked about this, maybe it was 2 weeks ago or so, but, you know, making sure that as you're using the different types of cleaning equipment to clean these items, A is keeping liquids out of the contacts, right? The plugins, the microphones, the speakers, those sorts of things, just kind of steering away from that. And then two, keeping the really caustic cleaners or the ones that might strip off some of the protective surfaces like on the screens. A lot of the screens are going to have that hydrophobic or oilophobic kind of covering on it that keeps, you know, your fingerprints from accumulating on there. But if you start to remove that using some heavy-duty cleaners, you're going to lose that benefit. So in that case, you know, you're just going to want to use just a moist or a damp towel, paper towel to clean those sorts of things. When it comes to your keyboards and mice, honestly, I guess I use Clorox wipes on those. The item there you might see too is too much cleaning. You might start to remove the letters from your keyboards, but you know, you just have to be careful about that. So just making sure that you know, you're using what's appropriate. And they actually make items that are designed to be used around electronic equipment. So if you have the ability to get that, those are good as well.
So Amos, I have go ahead.
Oh, really? Those are really good reminders because you know, I think we're still learning about COVID-19, and I've heard varying reports as far as how long it can live on a surface. Mm-hmm. And now most of us are no longer in the office, but in general, a keyboard, a mouse, those are some of the dirtiest things that exist in our world because we're touching things all day. We touch those, we touch food, we touch our face, we touch other things. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's a really good reminder, really best practices in today's world and in general.
So, John, I have just a spray that you put on a cloth and you know, just to clean your screen, which mostly does, you know, fingerprints and things like that. But none of that has any kind of, germ fighting. It doesn't kill germs at all. It's just to clean do they make products, is what I'm wondering, that do both, that clean the equipment, that are made for your equipment, but also disinfect it? And if so, why not?
I believe they do. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah. Word of warning. We're going to talk about kind of high doses of alcohol here. What to not break electronics is you can't get any moisture in it. And one of the things with any phone before you do anything, I would highly recommend you look up what it's called as IPX rating from the manufacturer. Many Android phones, especially budget, have none, which means if you get a drop of water any place on it, you probably will ruin the phone, especially the budget phone. So be very careful. But the problem really is getting stuff wet, moisture. Well, I actually do this for CPUs and stuff and motherboards. I actually clean motherboards, but you have to use a 99% alcohol, rubbing alcohol concentration, which is you normally have to special order or get because it can actually burn your skin and stuff. But any type of 70% should work pretty well. The main thing is alcohol would dry instantly and not leave any moisture or residue like water will. The cleaning solutions, the problem with that is they take off stuff. They're actually, you know, rub stuff off, and Apple warns about this, that it will break down your screen because there's a whole bunch of coatings on it. Even though it's glass, there's a lot of coatings, just like your eyewear, and you don't really want to break that down. So you can use a little bit of water, a little bit of glass cleaning solution, especially if you have eyeglass. Eyeglass will work too. But if you need to do germs, you really need to do like an alcohol, rubbing alcohol of 70, maybe lower. Or if you can get it, the 99% works really good, dries instantly, leaves no residue behind at all. That for sure will kill the virus off without getting into the really harsh stuff.
Do you take everything apart?
It's going to permanently damage stuff. The really harsh stuff will permanently damage equipment.
So if I have a case, you know, my personal cell phone just has a little case that you pop off. So it makes sense that you would pop that off and you would clean, you know, inside that case. If you have one of those thicker, you know, protective cases, do you still need to do that? Free the phone from its case and clean everything in the holder and the phone itself?
Well, I'll give two theories on that. Yes, and make sure you clean the case because that's where the virus is going to be at most. Also, don't give your phone out. if nobody else is using your phone and nobody, you know, sneezes on it, there's no need to clean it. It's not, the virus isn't going to magically just appear on the phone that's in your pocket when you're walking around infected people. That's not really how this happens. So, but there's other bugs you should be clean for too. But when you do clean it, you do watch the other case, clean everything, because the virus will migrate into the cracks and stuff. But the best solution is don't share your electronics at this time. And then as long as nobody's sneezing on it or coughing on it, you really don't need to clean it because you're the only one who's touching and using it.
Yeah, this is one of the things when everybody said, don't touch your face, but what do we have on our faces? We have our phones on our faces for so much throughout the day. I want to talk a little bit and go back and talk national politics and how that intersects with tech, because I'm curious, you know, President Trump had a press conference early on in this and said, you know, Google's working on this website, and Dr. Deborah Birx held up a flow chart kind of thing, and Google the next day said, no, that's not correct, and since then they've been kind of working on this. And I remember a lot of people were saying after the press conference, before they knew that the whole story had yet to be told, kind of had a sigh of relief with this sense that, you know, Google's on board. Google's going to take care of something. These big companies and private businesses and tech companies, they're here with us. There's a lot of emotion and politics, you know, in that. I'm curious what some of you thought about that moment and sort of what it says about, you know, how we view our tech companies in America. Who's excited by that question? Craig, how about you? what did you think about that?
Yeah, I've heard that. And, yeah, I watched the press conference earlier today, too. And, you know, it's just a very caustic environment. People are really afraid, you know. Yeah. And I think that there is this mass need to want to provide hope. I mean, it's something that we've all kind of been going through. Employees worried about losing their jobs. People worried about getting infected. Nobody knows if they can trust each other. And so there is kind of this sense from the administration to want to provide that in all facets of our life, from healthcare to technology, right? And just how we, you know, again, interact with each other. And, you know, these tech companies, some of them, you know, Elon Musk, I heard, is going to start producing ventilators for New York. Same with, you know, GM. And, you know, I think it's really great. I think it's kind of a testament to capitalism and how our system can work in this way. And, you know, there are also some fumbles, though, in that some of these big tech companies, I don't think anybody was really prepared, right? I mean, Google especially, the website that they were talking about, you know, it's seeing little activity in the testing phases. And it's a very... You know, it's a website that's very broad in scope, what it's supposed to do. And just from a smaller consumer standpoint, the only thing that I was going to say is that there have been a lot of people who've actually stepped up and provided public resources, just created them out of, you know, just like a shared, you know, kind of sense of goodwill. And I've seen some really interesting public resources pop up that are actually kind of better than some of these big tech companies. One is, you know, from a website called Reddit. They have this subreddit that's just dedicated to coronavirus and providing factual information. That's been really great. And another is a free resource, a website called infection2020.com, where you can actually track cases. And I've seen some of these public resources actually be better than government resources. And so it's very interesting.
So tell me better than the CDC website, like better than the CDC website, how, you know, give me an example of how something, because that's the risk, is that people go to, you know, a private website and they're not getting their information from the CDC. What makes it better? What have you seen that you think might be better?
Sure. So this website that I'm talking about specifically does track cases. And it pulls information from those government resources, from different government resources. So it's kind of a consolidation of a bunch of different ones. And again, you know, you can track some areas, you know, luckily, I guess South Dakota, you know, tests have kind of halted. So it's kind of actually, you know, it's probably best not to stray into that territory because, as you said earlier, it's 19 hours old. But some people really want to know, you know, how many cases are in my area, right? And like I said, some of these public resources that have been made available recently are pulling from news stations, local news stations. They're pulling from, like I said, some government databases if that information is available. And they are making maps, you know, that are kind of showing, how many cases, how many deaths, et cetera. Things that people want to know.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about that go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say from a big tech perspective, you know, 2019, last year was not a good year for big tech, right? Zuckerberg, Facebook mm-hmm. had a pretty rough year in the public relations. Amazon and Jeff Bezos had some blunders. In general, I think the sentiment we've always, you know, the FANG stocks, as they often occur, refer to them. So Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you know, generally have been really driving the market the last few years. And 2019 was a rough year on them from a public perception, trust, data, security, privacy, all these things. And so I actually think big tech has a chance, an opportunity here to step up, put their resources, put their innovation, put their brightest minds and engineers towards solving this problem, which not only does the main goal of solving this, you know, this problem, this virus, but also could have some ancillary benefits of just changing the public perception about these companies. So
right.
As Craig mentioned, you know, Tesla said, Elon Musk said, you know, we'll make ventilators, and GM is, they haven't, you know, I think they did that back in World War II, right? So these
right.
companies are willing to step up and do what it takes. And from my perspective, you know, I think it's going to be innovation, entrepreneurship, and science is our solution to getting this, to getting us out of this mess. And so social distancing is just trying to buy us time.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we can innovate our way out.
Right. And I just want to, you know, push back a little bit on Craig and the idea of other websites gathering information from news sources, because, you know, we had a listener send me a message the other day saying, you know, I heard this on the news at this station. Can you tell me if it's true? And it wasn't true. It was a little bit of a sloppy reporting, you know, with the way they worded. So would you pull things from news stations without having journalists there kind of vetting things and looking at those things, we can get ourselves in real trouble with some misinformation as well, which is, to John T's point, you know, the bashing of Twitter about sharing, you know, during the election and sharing misinformation, and what are you willing to do to crack down on misinformation? Go ahead.
I'd like to just point in one thing that this time around, Facebook and YouTube and many other social media have been very quick on cracking down on the fake news about the virus. YouTube has a news shelf they just posted up with all the authoritative stuff that goes through. And if you talk about the virus at all, you're demonetized at all if you're not an official site. So, and Facebook actually got so aggressive that they were actually blocking valid and good news articles about the virus. So many of the platforms are trying to stop the spread of false information as best as they can. And this is probably, they're doing more aggressive and better at it this time around than they've ever had in the past. So
yeah.
That's hopefully a better sign.
I think,
go ahead, Amos, sorry, go ahead.
I think two of the benefits of big tech getting involved in this, especially, you know, when you mentioned sites like Reddit, who has a specific subreddit on coronavirus, they're kind of a double-edged sword when you're doing crowdsourcing of information, right? One is you're able to get information from multiple different locations and multiple different areas of even the world, all in a single location without having to go very far. At the same time, you're also able to get that misinformation as well. But hopefully, in that crowdsourcing of those responses, you're going to have enough people who are able to correct that misinformation. One thing we can't do is go out there and read a single story or a single post by any one in particular person and just assume that it's absolutely true because it was on the internet. You're going to have to take that information and aggregate and find out who's using correct sources, who is validating their information, who is backing that their claims up with others, with other information, in order to be able to tell that. And I think that's one of the things that we're in this social media day and age is we're quick to read a salacious headline or something that's super inflammatory and then just repeat it because well, honestly, because it's just interesting, right? And it spurs conversation, and people get shocked, and shock value is high. So I think that's one of the things that is a benefit, is that crowdsourcing, and hopefully having a majority of people, again, hopefully, who have the correct information. And then the second thing real quick is, I think tech companies have, like Google, Apple, Facebook, in some cases have the ability to present information that's more consumable, more understandable than maybe the government does, maybe doing it in graphs, maybe doing it in charts or other ways that makes that information more easily understood by a common person who doesn't understand all the technical jargon that the CDC is giving out.
Yeah, and I think for anybody who tried to sign on to health insurance when the government first launched their site, if you remember, think back a little bit to the problems with that when the president said in the Rose Garden that Google was going to create the website. I think that was part of what people were clinging to. They were like, well, we know it's going to work and we know it's going to make sense, whereas a government website, people had a little memory of trepidation with. Let's
word is a government, you know, the president kind of sprung that on Google too. I believe the original agreement was they were building a site for the Bay Area, for, you know, for San Francisco.
Right. Yeah.
As the president loves to do, he made some big promises.
Yeah. So.
And one thing we should point out, it isn't Google that was developing that website. It was another company under their parent company called Alphabet. So it wasn't actually Google had no themselves. The company had no connection to this website. It's called like The Verge. It's a different company under the same parent company. So,
I mean, they own the company, but it's part of their like Google X. Yeah, it's a subsidiary. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I think everybody learned is when you hear the press conference and the president says, you know, the deadline for filing your taxes is now July 15th. People are fact-checking it. They're waiting for the next person to come up and say, nope, that's not quite, because some of the information in the press conferences has not turned out to be true, and we're all kind of scrambling with that info. I want to close this segment with a little bit of what John T. was saying, or maybe it was Amos, or, you know, somebody talked about, like, what's the future look like, and what are we learning now? I know here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, we've already initiated some, you know, using Microsoft Teams or what have you, and people have already said, we have to keep doing that. I mean, there was things that we didn't know we had at our disposal that turned out to be way more effective than how we were doing things before. Amos, how do you think things are going to change after this? You know, not being insensitive to what we're about to go through as well, but there's some real innovation ahead.
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. I think there's tools and resources that are available today that we don't take advantage of, mostly out of comfort and familiarity. That is the reason we don't do it today, having to learn a new resource for something that you don't have an immediate need for, like a Microsoft Teams or a Slack or any sort of those communication channels that if people understood and took advantage of, they would really make use of them and find them useful. But now that we've got this immediate need, we've got a reason why communication amongst groups of individuals inside businesses need that communication channel. You're going to have to figure it out, because that's the way we are going to be doing things for the next, who knows, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks or months. And so those sorts of things are going to then carry forward now that you've learned them, your understanding of them, you're familiar with them, and people will be able to continue to use that.
And John T. Meyer talked to us earlier in the week about some of those best practices, and that helped a lot of people I know. So I'll send you to our website, sdpb.org/COVID, for some of those like tips on how to work from home, how to lead a business when your employees are at home. So thank you so much for that. I'm going to let you gentlemen go. We're going to take a break and bring Heather Benson on by yourself to have the rest of this conversation. But I want to say thank you to Amos and John T. Meyer and Jeff Litterick and Craig Mount. We really appreciate it. We'll see you next time, guys. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. This is our Tech Radio Hour, and I'm sitting in for Kent Osborne today. SDPB's Heather Benson is with us now on the phone. Heather, hey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
All right, let's talk a little bit. By the way, people on Twitter are saying, wash your phones. This idea that if the phone is in your pocket, it's clean enough is not passing muster with a lot of listeners. So we'll just remind you again, find out what bottle phone you have and find out how to wash it and clean it and disinfect it appropriately. So I better clear that up before I get in trouble on Twitter, Heather.
And your phone touches your hands and your face. It's yes. A danger zone.
And then you touch your, you go, you know, you go everywhere, you touch things, and then you touch your phone, and then it touches your face. So,
yep. Yeah,
if you walk into a room with sick people and your phone's in your pocket, you still should probably wash your phone. All right, Heather.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about South Dakota Public Broadcasting coverage here. We've got the website, sdpb.org/COVID. There's been a huge digital push to get everything in one place for people, and you've been central to that. Give us an update for listeners who are trying to find the latest reliable information from SDPB.
Well, like everything else with COVID, this is an evolving project for SDPB as we figure out what we are producing and really what the state of South Dakota needs from us. And I can't say enough at how amazed I have been at our team and the amount of stuff we're churning out. It's absolutely unbelievable. But one of the things I suggest all people is check out the website and take a look around. It changes daily. We're adding content literally on the hour. And let us know what you need from us. We're actually going to be adding a text module right on the website where you can text us stories that you're interested in, questions that you have. And we want to hear from you. What do you need? We're working on education resources. We're working on your life resources. How do you live life during COVID? And, of course, all the breaking news that seems to come out and the fire hose of information on a daily basis. And if you're on social, we, of course, have our main South Dakota Public Broadcasting Facebook page and Twitter handles. But if you want all of that breaking news, we have secondary that's just news. That's at SDPB News on both Twitter and Facebook. And if that's what you're really tuned into and you want to stay super focused, I highly advise tuning into both of those.
South Dakota Focus was on TV last night, and people were sending in questions. We're taking questions here, and we don't have to be on the air for you to send us your question. We're kind of gathering them and using that as well to help inform our interviews, and that number is 605-956-7372. That's for a text, 605-956-SDPB. Are you seeing a lot of people kind of around? You spend a lot of time on social media at work for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, so you're maybe exposed to it more than I am. How are people in South Dakota, especially in those rural areas, really responding to, because we're seeing things that are happening in New York City that aren't happening here yet. We're making decisions about how we should be responding right now. What are you seeing out there?
Well, I think like a lot of the United States and the world for that matter, there's a bit of a mixed bag. You know, there's people who are understandable, very fearful, because when you don't have all the information that you maybe want, things can get scary. And then maybe those who aren't taking it as serious as they might. I think what I'm seeing a lot of that I really appreciate about South Dakota is those messages of support, those messages of uplifting each other and prayers for each other. And I have never lived in New York, but I don't know if you necessarily see that general sentiment spreading so widely on social like you do in this state. But I think one of the things that we all can watch out for as we're on social media is social media hygiene. We've heard it since especially the 2016 election. Check your sources, check your sources, check your sources. And in this scenario, checking your sources can literally save lives. If you have bad information that you are sharing or even liking or even, you know, taking that extra time to pause and scroll, you're helping that post circulate further. So if you see something you know isn't true, Facebook has a way for you to mark it as spam. Do that. Let them do their review process and help them do their jobs. And one of the things that I've found very frustrating in this social news cycle is people will post something, find out it's untrue, and then laughingly make a comment but not delete it. If you know that you accidentally post something untrue, it's your social responsibility to then delete that post. So practice your social hygiene to a degree that you're practicing your hand washing because it matters. You put out the wrong info, you spread the wrong info, you might impact someone else's life very negatively.
On Point this morning, Magna Chakrabarty said, how do we rise to the moral demands of this moment? And I know there are, you know, as journalists, as, you know, employees of South Dakota Public Broadcasting, these are, you know, these are the ethical guidelines that we follow on a daily basis. And what I've seen is a lot of people who want to, you know, who are used to sort of acting as reporters in their minds and saying, here, I saw this, and it can be great information about what's happening in the world right in front of you, but with it comes a responsibility to think before you post. And I was wondering, I don't know what you thought, Heather, but here in Sioux Falls, at least, there were early posts about empty shelves in stores that I found irresponsible. I went to the grocery store and I saw one of those shelves, and then I saw it being restocked within 20 minutes of, you know, by the time I got from one end of the grocery store to the other. And I took a picture of the shelf when I walked by, and I came back and took a picture again and said, see, it was empty for right now because they didn't expect that many people to come in, but then they filled it. But everybody else was just posting this, there's no toilet paper at this store, and there's no, you know, ibuprofen at this store. And at some point, you're really part of the problem.
Yeah, and it's our responsibility to each other and to ourselves to think every time before we post. That's true every single day. But you have a very large megaphone when you get on social media, you as an individual South Dakotan. And so just like you wouldn't take a megaphone to the town square and start screaming random things, think about whether you want to take that megaphone to your social media world and say things that aren't necessarily backed up by facts.
Yeah. And then I do want to say that as also now is the time to really be grateful for social media and for the technology that we have for all these people who are separated. This is a lifeline for people to be able to connect and tell their stories and you know, see musicians playing, see parents talking to their kids, loved ones separated and not being able to get home. This is a real powerful moment if we rise to the moral obligation of it.
And I think you touched on something important. I remember that social media was created for us to socialize.
Yeah.
And this is a great opportunity to use it for what matters. You're connected to your friends and family. Let them hear from you. Bring each other into your lives. Talk about, you know, what's going on, the good things. Uplift each other. There's that opportunity, just like you would see, you know, your grandmother and tell her about the good things of your day. Well, you can do that on social media as well. And it can be a space for some peace and some calming instead of a nonstop barrage of panic.
Yes, well said. Heather Benson, thank you. And one of my favorite social media posts right now is a view from the farm and some of those farm animals. And another one of my friends has Harriet the lamb playing with a kitten. And that's just a nice breather at the end of a rough news cycle. Heather, thanks so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Laurie.